First, can climate policy in this country and globally survive COVID-19? The Climate Change Minister has tasked the government's independent advisor on climate change to review whether New Zealand's target for the next decade is ambitious enough. New Zealand has committed to an average 30% reduction on 2005 emission levels between next year and 2030. The Climate Change Commission will now review that pledge to ensure it aligns with the goal unanimously agreed by Parliament last year of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. James Shaw says New Zealand is once again showing leadership by committing to this review. But with COVID-19 cutting a swathe through the global economy, what is the risk that previously made commitments could fall by the wayside? And as the government here gets set to pour money into shovel-ready projects, what might we see by means of green infrastructure investments? James Shaw, good morning.
Good morning.
Why undertake this review now?
Well, because we've got the deadline of the next UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, coming up. Obviously, that itself has been delayed due to COVID. But when we signed up the Paris Agreement, there was a decision to say that countries would take another look at their commitments by this year. And so that's what we've said that we would do. And we're going to crack on with it.
So what does the review involve?
Well, quite a lot has changed since we committed to that target back in 2015-2016. For example, we know a lot more about the science, and we've had the UN's report in 2018 on the science of trying to hit 1.5 degrees. And also, of course, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, Parliament has committed to New Zealand living within that threshold of 1.5 degrees. So all of that has happened since we first set that target, and we just basically want to take another look at it and say, was the target that was set back in 2016, does that still meet the requirements that have emerged since then?
What happens if the Commission comes back and says no?
Well, we've asked them to say if they don't think that it's adequate, to give us some advice on what they think that we ought to be doing, and then we have to take that to Parliament. And that's the sort of process that was set out in the Zero Carbon Bill that we passed last year.
How specific are the plans to reach even the targets that we have? What sort of reporting is done to you?
Well, we get... we've got pretty good reporting, but there's always a time lag to it. So last week we published the report for the 2017 to 2018 year, which is the last year that we've got verified data for. So there's always a bit of a delay. MFE are currently working through what they think our likely emissions are with current policy settings. And we know that even though we've done a lot over the course of the last 2.5 years, that we actually need to put in place, you know, particularly sector-specific policies around things like transport, energy, housing, agriculture and so on, to help bend the curve of our emissions downwards.
Is now the time to be talking about this, to reducing emissions more than what we have already committed to, i.e. 30% on 2005 levels by 2030?
Well, I mean, I know that people are feeling an enormous amount of uncertainty because of COVID-19, and, you know, frankly, probably the worst of it in economic terms is yet to come. But the issue that we've got is, A, climate change isn't going away. Obviously, there's less air pollution going into the atmosphere at the moment, but that is a very temporary reprieve, and it'll all still be there when we kind of get back to business, if you like. But the other thing is that the government is about to spend, frankly, an astonishing amount of money trying to resuscitate the economy, soak up unemployment, you know, rebuild industries and so on, look for new export markets to help to replace those that have taken a bit of a hit, build the New Zealand brand. So actually, given the scale of the investment that we're putting up, now is the perfect time to be saying, well, given that we're borrowing those tens of billions of dollars off our children and our grandchildren to get us through the COVID crisis. And given that if we fail to avert a climate catastrophe, that will also impose costs on our children and grandchildren. We've actually got both a moral and an economic duty to spend the money getting through the climate crisis on things that reduce those long-term challenges for the generations who are paying for it. So, you know, we can actually hit two birds with one stone here by, through the program of recovery, come out the other side of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis in a way that helps us to address those long-term challenges that are there anyway and will still be there when we get back.
Is your fear that that won't happen? Is your fear that the rush to stimulate an economy that is going through an absolutely astonishing contraction right now and is facing months of recession, that in the rush to deal with the immediate problem, the reverse will happen? It'll be a rush to whatever's ready to go, whatever can be brought forward, and the focus on getting the dollars flowing without the bigger picture.
Yeah, look, that is a risk. And if you look at human history, you know, there is a sort of an economic shock of one description or another. Nothing as severe as the one that we're going through now, but they do happen about every 10 years. And it is an entirely understandable human response when you're in one of those crises and you are faced with the, you know, prospect of, you know, one or more people in your household, you know, losing their jobs or seeing a dip in their income and so on, to say, look, I just want things to go back to the way they were before. It is completely understandable. And governments in New Zealand and the world over have generally responded by pumping money into restoring the status quo. Unfortunately, one of the features of the status quo is that it was an environmentally unsustainable pathway. And so if we do that again this time, we will be locking in a failure to reduce our emissions and to avoid climate change. And I do think, at least here, that we are looking at the lessons of history and saying, actually, we can't afford to do that one more time. We do actually have a responsibility to envision a better future and a better world for our children and our grandchildren. And we can make choices about how to create employment, rebuild industries, rebuild our export markets, and so on, in a way that serves that longer-term view, not just the immediate response. And I have to say that my colleagues in the government are thinking that way, to say, look, you know, yes, we have to very quickly move to rebuild the economy and to rebuild or get, you know, as close back to towards full employment as we can. But let's do it with wisdom. Let's not repeat the kind of same mistakes that previous experiences have shown.
Are they? Who is planning at the moment for the stimulus that needs to start as soon as possible and what it will look like? We keep hearing this phrase, shovel-ready projects. Does that mean roads? Does that mean, like, what are the projects on the table that you might do as well, by the way, because you just need to get moving? But what are the projects on the table and what else is being considered for billions and billions of dollars of investment? What's being discussed?
Well, there's things being discussed in every single category, and there's three waves to this, right? There's the immediate response of dealing with the crisis and cushioning the blow on people, and that's where things like the wage subsidy and, you know, the various other sort of support programs that we've got have been rolled out, and obviously that's where a lot of the attention has been in recent weeks. Then there is kind of preparing for the recovery, which is the sort of next 3 to 6 months. And then there is the next 12 to 24 months after that. The shovel-ready projects that you're referring to is about that kind of second tranche, that second wave of activity. I haven't seen the list yet. It's coming to ministers, I think, in the next few weeks. But I am led to believe that there are literally thousands of projects that have been proposed, either by government agencies or by private businesses, or by local councils, or social enterprises around the country. Some of those will be ready to go. Others of them will probably not be ready, and they might get pushed into that third, longer-term rebuild program. But we know that You know, people are proposing projects in energy and housing and transport and fresh water and forestry conservation and urban water and three waters infrastructure. I mean, you name it. We know that there is a backlog of work in this country that we haven't been paying attention to anyway over the course of the last 30 years. And those things give you an immediate sense of what needs to happen next.
Okay. I'm looking at one of projects that are just put forward from one council, and they're probably fairly typical. Upgrades to the library and art gallery, sewerage, stormwater and water supply upgrades, an irrigation screen, a scheme, a sealing, a road that's unsealed to cater for forestry and tourism expansion, rehabilitation and sealing of another road, cyclist and walkers, construction of a trail.
Yeah.
These are all, you know, completely valid projects one can hear. But when you put a climate lens across, not whether or not you do these, but a climate lens across all of the projects that are happening and that could happen, are you seeing a trajectory towards your goal or not? In other words, there's going to be a heck of a lot of construction of things and upgrading of things that might be entirely valid, but not really much that shifts the dial.
Well, no. I think that there will be, and like you say, that is one of the lenses that we're going to be applying when we do actually get this list and taking a look and saying what's the priority. But often there are things where you get sort of multiple benefits. And I'll give you an example. In the construction sector, we know that the number of jobs per dollar spent is higher for residential house construction than it is for tall buildings. And also there's more jobs created per dollar spent in building tall buildings than there is in horizontal infrastructure, which is, you know, things like roads and so on. And so if you're trying to create employment and fix a long-term problem, how you prioritise, you know, you might want to say, well, actually, we do actually need horizontal infrastructure. We do need taller, larger buildings, but also we need a lot of houses. Let's make sure that the things that are the job-rich ones are prioritised. That helps to deal with unemployment, but also, turns out, we do have a housing crisis. That also hasn't gone away. And as we build more houses, we have an opportunity to make sure that those houses are energy efficient, climate-friendly, warm and dry and safe. And so you can create multiple outcomes. It's not. I think the historically, there has been a view that these things have to be traded off against it. That's always been the narrative. Oh, you can either have the economy or you can have the environment. You can either have jobs or you can have the environment. Actually, in a number of cases, you get optimal outcomes by combining those things together, not treating them as trade-offs, but saying actually there's a synthesis of those. Where actually by focusing on creating good outcomes, you actually get the best of both.
Do you have advice on whether, as it stands, New Zealand is on a trajectory to meet its 2030 pledge?
With current settings, no, we're not.
Okay. With what's about to happen now, looking at the immediate need to get an economy up off its knees and stop even more damage, but also looking out over a decade, which is how long it takes for many of these projects probably to be, some of them anyway, to be fulfilled, is there a plan to shape a program that puts us on target for that 2030 goal? There's no point in making it tougher if we can't attain the one we've got, as the Minister.
Sure. No, I understand that. So the plan that we've got came off the back of the Productivity Commission's report in 2018 on how to transform the economy to be one that is, fit for the future. And the government passed a climate action plan in response to that last year. We accepted all 77 recommendations that the Productivity Commission had put through, and then that work has been farmed out to a wide range of agencies, including the Ministry of Economic Development, Housing, Energy, Transport, MPI, you name it. They've all got sort of various bits of this plan. And they do deal with all of those key sectors where we have seen we've either got high emissions or we've got growing emissions. That plan has been in train for about a year now. Obviously, the COVID crisis has put a bit of a dent in those plans, and we're still trying to assess what that means in terms of delays or reprioritisation or anything like that. But the things that we need to do haven't changed. And because we are about to invest this very large sum of money in restoring the economy, actually, we can think about accelerating some of those plans because there are sums of money on the table for industry and so on that simply were not on the table 6 weeks ago.
Okay, and are you at that table with your portfolio? Because it's a very busy place at the moment, and are you there?
Yes, I am. And actually, remember, I'm also an Associate Minister of Finance. So there's Grant, is obviously the leader of that particular group of ministers. There's myself, there's Shane Jones, and there's David Parker. And so the projects that are coming through get reviewed by that they're called the Budget Ministers Group, and you know, as they get discussed with the wider government. So, you know, we bring that kind of economic lens, but we're also there to make sure that the broader set of considerations about where we want the recovery to go to that table.
There's an elephant in the room, which is what happens to the Paris Accord and what the rest of the world does, because as many will argue, actually in the end, when it comes to the overall climate outcome, nothing that New Zealand does directly affects that, given how minuscule we are. However, we have to be part of a combined effort and a combined system. Is that agreement at risk of collapse, effectively, as a result of this pandemic?
No, I don't think so. It's not ever really been in the best of shape, but I think there will be countries that do backtrack, saying, "Look, you know, we've got to deal with the COVID crisis." I think, frankly, many developing countries who don't have the kinds of health systems to be able to cope with the crisis will find it very difficult to be able to maintain momentum. But if you look at some other countries in the world, South Korea, the UK, the EU at large, at Costa Rica, and others, have said exactly what I'm saying, which is that they want the COVID recovery to be directed in such a way to help us to create, you know, a kind of a vibrant economy and society, but one that's at the same time more sustainable and lower emission than the one that we've got at the moment.
Oil prices went negative in the United States for the first time in history this week and then bounced back above. This is Texas. And Brent crude oil, I think, which affects our petrol prices, fell by something like 20%, the biggest fall in many, many years. However, speaking to our analyst yesterday, Bob McNally, an American analyst, every time there's a bust, there's a boom. And is there a risk that even with record low oil prices in one case and years low in another, what will come off the back as economies recover is actually a booming oil price, and that industry will redouble?
That is a risk as well. The demand, frankly, it hasn't gone away in the medium to longer term, because once countries come out of lockdown and economic activity returns, people will still be driving around in their cars, right? So, you know, yes, there is a very unusual and very steep dip at the moment, but that will come back. That's why we need to do things like accelerate the transition to electric vehicles and so on. It's why we need to accelerate the transition for our industrial heat from coal and gas to electricity that is produced from renewable sources. And that is how we deal with the fossil fuel industry, is by stopping buying their products and replacing them with renewables. And I guess that's sort of part of what I'm saying, is that we actually do have a moment in time now where we can say, are there projects that would help to accelerate that transition that were going to be difficult to execute prior to the COVID crisis, but that now has sufficient scale to be able to generate large-scale employment for a country that's, you know, going to go through a lot of churn in the next few months and achieve those long-term outcomes. And
so when does that decision get made? Is there a set decision for it, or is it iterative? You know, this project comes up, or that project comes up.
It is iterative, yeah.
And is that the best way to approach it?
Absolutely it is. Look, the situation that we are in is extremely dynamic. It's not like a normal year where the government spends 6 months putting together the budget and then in May says, look, here's what we're going to do for the next 12 months to 4 years. You know, we have to deal with the fact that the crisis has, shall we say, emergent properties, and we need to be able to be nimble enough to be making decisions on an ongoing basis, and to be able to respond to how that happens. But you know, there is going to be a budget in May, and there will be a set of announcements that should give you a sense of the direction that we're going in.
Thank you for your time. James Shaw is Climate Change Minister and Green Party co-leader.